Perspectives on Easter, a 10-10 Thrive special. I was born in the Judean town of Arimathea, a rural village with a small population of farmers and shepherds. Still, the town was located along a major trade route and brought travelers and merchants through the area. My family owned the largest farm in the village, and we sold many goods to both the local population and to those who passed through from time to time. As the firstborn in my family, I began my education in the Torah of the Bible at a young age. As I grew older, I studied other Jewish texts and traditions, including the Mishnah and the Talmud. Once I completed my basic education, I began studying with many of the great scholars of the day, including Gamaliel, who eventually became my colleague in the Sanhedrin, but more on that later. When I was 20, I joined the community of Pharisees. Like me, many of the Pharisees in Jerusalem were men of standing and wealth, and many of the leaders of synagogues throughout Judea were Pharisees. Although we were a minority in the Sanhedrin and held a minority number of positions as priests, we often controlled the decision-making of the Sanhedrin because of our positions of privilege and because we had popular support among the people. I first met Jesus when he was still alive during his ministry. I had heard of Jesus and his teachings, and I was curious to see for myself. What I found was a man who spoke with an authority that I had never encountered before. His words were like a balm to my troubled soul, and I knew that he was someone special. I began to follow him, listening to his teachings and witnessing his miracles, but I did so secretly for fear of the Jews. Jesus was seen as a threat to that order, and there were many who wanted him silenced. From time to time, when some in our council proposed that he be dealt with, I objected. This often placed me at odds with the high priest, Joseph Caiaphas, who was already unfavorably disposed toward me because I was a Pharisee and he was a Sadducee. Finally, during the week of Passover, one of the 12 agreed to betray Jesus, and Caiaphas authorized his arrest. It happened late in the evening on Thursday, and by early Friday, the Sanhedrin had assembled to hear charges against Jesus. The trial that morning was completely illegal, and the witnesses who were brought forward were clearly lying. Yet, Jesus was found guilty of blasphemy and referred to the Roman authorities for execution. I tried to do my part to stop the madness, but I was outvoted. Eventually, after more sham trials, Jesus' death sentence was confirmed. Within hours of his arrest, he was crucified on Calvary, and as I watched in horror, he died. According to Jewish law, a person who is executed must be buried before sunset on the same day as the execution. Leaving Jesus' body on the cross overnight would have violated this law. I wanted to secure an honorable burial for my Lord, and so I approached the governor, Pontius Pilate, and asked that he release Jesus' body to me. In asking for the body, I stepped out of the shadows and publicly declared myself to be a follower of Jesus. I knew that this might cause the end of my career, and it might even cost me my life, but I knew it was the right thing to do. Most crucified victims in ancient Rome were left on the cross even after they were dead, and the elements and the animals took care of the mess that was left. It was not unusual, however, for Roman authorities to grant the body of a crucified person to his friends or family, provided he was not guilty of high treason. Jesus had been convicted of sedition. However, I believe that Pilate executed him to prevent a riot, rather than because the Lord was guilty of attempting to overthrow Rome. Pilate was surprised to hear that Jesus was already dead. He summoned the centurion in charge to confirm this. When he learned that Jesus was indeed dead, he gave me permission to bury the body. Nicodemus, my colleague, and another secret disciple agreed to help me. After we were granted custody, we immediately began to wrap the body for burial. Following Jewish custom, we wrapped Jesus in strips of linen and mixed in myrrh and aloe. However, it was the day of preparation, the sixth day of the week, just before the Sabbath, and it was late in the day. So we hurriedly placed Jesus in my own tomb, one that had been in my family for years, located in a garden outside the city near Golgotha. The tomb was in a cave hewn in Limestone Hill. Some of the women wanted to do more to anoint the body, but I told them to come back the first day of the week. After placing the body inside the tomb, we had a stone rolled in front of the entrance. This great stone was set on an incline and a channel cut in the rock, making it easier to cover the tomb by rolling the stone downhill. It took several men to roll the stone back up the incline, which we hoped would discourage grave robbers and wild animals from trying to enter the tomb. When Nicodemus and I left, Mary Magdalene and another Mary remained behind at the gravesite. Unbeknownst to us, our choice to put Jesus in my tomb fulfilled Isaiah's prophecy spoken hundreds of years before Jesus' death. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. I realized this sometime later, when I was speaking with two of Jesus' disciples who had walked with him from Jerusalem to Emmaus. This is just one of the many prophecies that confirm Jesus' identity as the Messiah and Son of God. The heavy stone should have been good enough for Caiaphas and the other religious authorities, but their paranoia that a story might circulate about a resurrected Jesus prompted them to take further action. The next day, when they should have been keeping the Sabbath, they went to Pilate and requested that he give permission to not only seal the grave, but also place Roman soldiers on guard. They took these extra measures to prevent the theft of Jesus' body, so fearful were they of losing their esteem. But they had little to fear. The disciples had scattered when Jesus was arrested. The only one of the 12 that I saw at the trial before the Sanhedrin, in front of Pilate or Herod or at the cross, was John, the youngest of them all. Mostly I saw women and some of the other followers who were not members of the inner circle. Still, they had the grave further secured. The seal was made from clay and it was imprinted with the Roman imperial seal and attached to the stone with a rope. Breaking the seal would incur the wrath of the empires if someone could get past the guards. And there were several guards who were posted there. On the third day, I was at home when I got word that the stone had been rolled away and the tomb was empty. I went to the gravesite to see for myself. It was true. Later that day, I was with my colleagues when Caiaphas summoned the guards to give an account of what happened. The guards described an earthquake, the appearance of an angel, the rolling back of the stone from the tomb, and their fainting. They added that when they regained consciousness, the tomb was empty. Jesus was gone. Caiaphas had them bribed to keep this to themselves. However, not too long thereafter, word began to reach us that there were eyewitnesses who claimed that they had encountered a risen Jesus. I became excited when I heard this. Could it be true? If so, it would be further proof that Jesus was indeed whom he said he was. All these years later, I am still overwhelmed by what happened. Despite all the evidence, there are still many unbelievers. Some dismiss the resurrection as a myth, others say that it was some sort of trick, and even though I never saw the risen Jesus in person, I know many people who did, and I know it is the truth. It is a truth that transformed my life and that has given me hope even in the darkest of times.